How many of you in the room have a brain? See, now, three hands went up. It's a trick question. Let me just tell you what we're going to do. We're going to show a movie, first of all, that the Science Network did to explain, as best as we could, the brain initiative to a wider audience. And then we're going to have four panelists come up. I will talk to them. We'll have a conversation. And then I'll probably come amongst you and see if you have any questions. So let's start at least with the movie.
Everything that you see, hear, think, feel, or do is the product of your brain. Your ideas, your dreams, your memories, your hopes and your fears, your sense of yourself reside in that wondrously complex personal universe populated by 100 billion cells called neurons and functioning literally as your headquarters. How does it work? How does the coordinated activity of neurons in circuits produce the experience of being you? That's the grand challenge, to decipher the inner language of the brain and apply that knowledge to better understand and treat devastating disorders like depression, schizophrenia and autism, Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, epilepsy and traumatic brain injury, to accelerate the science of learning and even explore the mysteries of the mind. To understand imagination, we'll take a feat of the imagination. So, imagine a visionary venture that sets out to do all this and more by creating transformational technologies and powerful partnerships between scientists, engineers, and industry. A collaborative and ethically responsible project to understand the dynamic functions of the brain. Imagine that, and you have the Brain Initiative. Brain research through advancing, innovative neurotechnologies. The Brain Initiative is a bridge to understanding ourselves. We already know a lot about how individual neurons send and receive signals in milliseconds. Using techniques like functional MRI, we're painting the big picture, activity across the whole brain in seconds to minutes. But that leaves a vast territory still to be explored. We need a bridge between the microscopic and the macroscopic. We need to produce real-time pictures of complex neural circuits and visualize the rapid-fire interactions of cells. The Brain Initiative is that bridge. Remember, the brain's business is traffic. It traffics in information, traveling at the speed of thought. A project to create a static structural brain map is already underway, the connectome. In contrast, the Brain Initiative will provide a dynamic view of the brain, setting the stage for understanding neuronal codes, the regulation of behavior, how we think, learn and remember, the life of the mind. Now is the time to climb aboard the brain train for the ride of your life, of all our lives. From little brains like the worm to more complex creatures like the crab, the fruit fly, the zebra finch, the mouse, and you. The Brain Initiative accelerates our search for solutions. On the journey, we'll create new technological tools, discover new medical techniques and improve healthcare, create new industries, and inspire new generations of young people to become scientists and engineers. The Brain Initiative is an audacious adventure, taking the fast track to knowledge and carrying us to an unprecedented level of understanding of ourselves. Now is the time to ride the Exploration Express into our future. Thank you.
So, given the response to my question earlier, it's obvious that there's plenty of room on the brain train. We need a lot of you to get on board it, don't we? So, let's have a conversation at least about some of the things that we brought up in the movie, and let's bring the panelists up, please. And then I'll introduce you when you're up here. So, Terry Sanofsky is director of the Computational Neurobiology Lab at Salk. He's also at the Institute for Neural Computation at UCSD. He's a pioneer in computational neuroscience. I'm doing these briefly because you already have these available in your hands. He's actually a member of the new advisory committee to the director at the National Institutes of Health, the Brain Working Group. And it's worth mentioning that Terry is only one of only 10 living people to be a member of all three national academies. Next to him, Ralph Greenspan. Bob already explained that Ralph is Associate Director of the Kavli Institute for Brain and Mind at UC San Diego, but was yesterday perhaps, announced that he's Director of the new UCSD CBAM, which stands for Center for Brain Activity Mapping. Then we have Todd Hilton, who's Senior Vice President of Brain Corporation. He was actually at DARPA before, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which you saw was one of the places acknowledged up there, and is now working on a number of technologies that I won't elaborate here, but perhaps we can get into it a little bit later. The final panelist, Tony Lewis, is Senior Director at Qualcomm, Senior Director of Product Management at Qualcomm Technology Research and Development, and is an expert in neuromorphic technology. How many of you know what neuromorphic technology is? We will find out. There's two of you. Okay. All right, so let's move on. But let me give you a little question first. This is the 10th May issue of Science. And there was a policy forum in there, which was written by Tom Insull, Story Landis, and Francis Collins. And I want to read you a couple of paragraphs. One of them says that many scientists have been skeptical of an ambitious new project when support of existing science is eroding. Others have been confused about how this project will accomplish its goals because mapping the brain is far more complex and open-ended than mapping the genome. Still others have speculated about whether this is really a new initiative with new funding or if it simply reflects rebranding of current research. And there's a final paragraph here. We predict that the Brain Initiative will not only transform neuroscience, but will yield the intellectual and technological framework for better diagnostics and therapeutics for the millions worldwide who suffer from brain disorders. So that's a huge agenda with some caveats in there. And I wonder if we could start talking about that and see how you see these remarks and how you feel about where this project is currently placed and what the vision is and how realizable. Terry, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, first of all, the two most important letters are in brain initiative is I and N, innovative neurotechnology. That is to say, this is a tool-building approach. And the idea is that if we have better tools that will accelerate the research we're doing now, a lot of good labs working away, if we can double or increase by a factor of 10 the number of neurons they can study, this is going to really make the discoveries come a lot more quickly. So let's think a little bit about where we are now in terms of being able to help people who have brain disorders. So most of the drugs that are now used to treat schizophrenia and depression and Alzheimer's were discovered serendipitously. In other words, someone noticed that they were taking a hypertensive drug and it helped their depression. Most of these drugs have been on the market for over 20 years and they haven't been replaced. It's been very difficult. There are no drugs in the pipeline right now for mental disorders, no new drugs. So that's a real concern because the cost to the country is over $600 billion a year for mental health care. That's a huge burden. now, technology right now allows us to help people through some surgical procedures. And let me just tell you one very successful example. For Parkinson's disease, we know L-DOPA helps, but there are some people who are resistant to it, for whom they've built a tolerance. So there's a new approach now, which has been been pioneered. It's called deep brain stimulation. And the way it works is to lower an electrode deep into the human brain into an area called the basal ganglia. It has to be precisely positioned. And you turn on a stimulator, and you stimulate. And miraculously, within minutes, a lot of the patients who are frigid or rigid or are jittering, you know, they have a tremor. Suddenly, the tremor stops. They can get up and they can walk. It's miraculous. Now, we don't understand fully why that works, but we do know that being able to stimulate certain parts of the brain can alleviate diseases that were thought to be intractable. And another good example of that more recently is depression. So if you have if you have clinical depression and none of the drugs are of help, there is another approach that Helen Mayberg has pioneered, which is deep brain stimulation of the anterior cingulate cortex. And again, it's only in a small number, like 10 or 20% of the patients respond. But when they do respond, they say it's almost instantaneous. It's as if a curtain suddenly has risen, and suddenly the world, which is gray and bleak, has become colorful again, and they can think, and they can plan the future. So this is telling us that these are not life sentences, these mental disorders, and if we could only figure out more about the basic fundamental problem, why is the brain in these patients not working properly? We need to be able to develop probes to go into their brains and understand those mechanisms at the circuit level, at the level of hundreds of thousands of neurons of interacting very tightly. We don't have the tools. We can record from a small number of neurons, but that's not going to tell us the bigger picture. Now, this is, you know, they're going to look back 100 years from now, they're going to say, you know, they actually thought that by putting telephone poles into the brain, they were going to cure it, right? I mean, this is roughly how crude it is today. But with developing these new tools with nanotechnology, we will be able to not just record, but to stimulate from hundreds of thousands, millions of neurons, and be able to go in and rebalance the circuit in much finer ways to target specific cell types. There are thousands of different types of cells in different parts of the brain. And if we could just target the ones that are the important ones, the relevant ones, we can individualize treatment for every person who has one of these disorders that we can treat now with deep brain stimulation. But now let's just think about that from the perspective of the future. Okay, suppose that we have the technology. Suppose that we can selectively stimulate a million neurons wherever we want them. Well, you've created a new pipeline into the brain. Your eye, your retina, has 1 million ganglion cells going into your brain. And that means that we're going to have the same bandwidth. We're going to add another sensory ability to your brain that's as powerful as vision. Now, just think about what the implications are for that.
Why don't we ask Todd and Tony and talk to us about why companies like Qualcomm and Brain Corp, who work together, as I understand it, are involved. It seems to come from what Terry was just talking about. So how realistic is this, and why are you interested in brain?
Why are we interested in the brain? So I would say that you know, we're trying to build neuromorphic computers. So what's a neuromorphic computer? It's a device which mimics the processing done in the brain and can simulate it very well at low power. And so the possibility is that you can create computers that can, if you can get the facts right, you can create a computer which can perceive the world and interact with the world in the same way that humans can. You know, so everyone knows that you use cell phones today, and they're becoming closer and closer companions for people. And you can only imagine this is going to accelerate. And if these devices are going to become very good companions, then they have to also share our worldview, the way we see the world. So when I look out at the audience, I see a bunch of people. When a computer camera looks out at the audience, it sees a bunch of pixels and light levels. And translating that into understanding has been very difficult using traditional techniques. So hopefully, we would be able to use information derived from fundamental neuroscience to inform us as to how to build better algorithms to program these machines. Now, until recently, it wasn't a problem. The problem was created, I think, partially by Todd. Because when I got into this, people were talking about building neuromorphic devices, and they had a handful of neurons on board. So, you know, 5, 6, 10, you know, maybe 100 neurons if you're really ambitious. And at that level, maybe you could program things by hand. You could get inspiration from insect nervous systems. With Todd's program, the Synapse program, they started to talk about building systems with 1 million neurons, and then maybe 100 million neurons. And people are now talking about building a computer with 1 billion neurons on board. And the thing is that we're on the cusp of having this technology, but we don't know what we can put inside this technology. How do we load it up, make it do something interesting? And so, and this is fundamentally driven by the idea that while neuroscientists have been very good at telling us how single neurons work, we have a lot less data as to how ensembles of neurons work together to understand the world. So if we can gain some understanding through the Brain Initiative, then we should be able to load these machines up that we're building, that we can build, that are technologically possible today, and allow them to do something interesting.
And so I'll just make a few comments to follow up on that. So it's actually been a number of years that people have been doing large-scale neural simulations. Am I ringing or something? And in fact, Eugene Izakevich, who's over here, who's the CEO of Brain Corporation, did a simulation of, I think, 100 billion neurons almost 8 years ago. Now, that 100 billion neuron simulation, I think, took 50 days to do 1 second of real-time brain simulation. And the model was essentially a bunch of neurons talking to each other, but nobody wasn't really doing anything, so to speak. But since that time, it's become clear that we can actually build computing machines that are much, much more efficient for this kind of problem than we have been able to in the recent past. And that's what I was working on at DARPA. I had a project which was called Synapse, which was about how do we build large-scale neuromorphic computers. I'm sorry, the microphone is sort of confusing me. How do we build large-scale neuromorphic computers so that they become practical things, so that it becomes practical to do things like 1 million neurons or even 1 billion neurons? So today it's quite clear that we can do million neuron networks on small chips that use only a few watts of power. And there are a number of groups around the world working on this problem, including us, but also IBM is working on it, Hewlett-Packard is working on it, Hughes Research Laboratories are working on it. They were all part of my Synapse project. There are large projects in Europe now, in Heidelberg and in Manchester, with similar ambitions, and many academic groups, across the world working on it, including Jeff Kretschmar, who's here in the back. So I think it's an opportune time for us. But it's not the case that just because you can do a large-scale simulation that you can make the simulation do something that you care about. And that's why the Brain Initiative is important. We can make huge neural models now. We can get all kinds of cool activity in them. What we at Brain Corporation are doing is we're taking those things and we intend to make brains for robots. And that's what we're doing. Okay, we're going to be the brains for robots guys. And the information that we would glean, and we can do that to a degree now. But the idea that you'd like to have a general learning capability, a general learning machine, still eludes us. And that's why information from, say, the Brain Initiative would be so valuable for us.
The brains for robots thing is, do you find that people are a little bit scared when you say things like that? As you well know, there's this effect called the uncanny valley effect, where at some point, robots are going to be, according to that theory, at least indistinguishable from us, and it's going to be Blade Runner world with androids and so on. I assume that you would say that that's an unrealistic worry.
Well, I think that's quite far-fetched. I mean, that's movie stuff. I mean, the point I like to make to people when they bring that up is I say, well, how many robots did you see today? And the answer is typically zero. The only place you see robots are in movies. So I think it's a little far-fetched to worry about robots taking over the world. I think actually the robots that we will build will be things that, as Tony described, they are not obtrusive in any way. They are things that are simply embedded in our world that are helping us do things that we need to be done. And they probably won't look much like humans most of the time.
Right. Okay. So, Ralph, let me come back to you and go back to this point here that Tom Insulin et al. Wrote about, whether this is really a new initiative with new funding or it simply reflects rebranding of current research. And could you answer that in context of your own new center and what's going on there?
Well, as Bob mentioned, we now have a new center for brain activity mapping at UCSD. And one of the things that we are optimistic about, and this community for whom this meeting has been organized is going to be crucial in this, we gather that there's potential for a great deal of support from sources not only being the government funding agencies, but in large measure because of the many technological aspects that need to be developed for this, and that will have very broad applications when they are developed, not just in neuroscience, but in all of biomedical science, and probably not just in biomedical areas, but also in general applications even outside of that. Sensors, communicators, all integrators, all sorts of things of that sort will have very broad applications. So we are optimistic that there, in fact, can be sources of funding for this kind of basic science effort that can come from many sources. And we don't know exactly what our university will do, but we even think that they want to try to help in this regard as well. But in any event, we think that this is the kind of thing that because of the extent of its potential, has a very broad base for potential support.
Okay, I mean, doesn't this strike you? I mean, you've been involved, from both of you, from the very beginning, and when we were in the middle of doing this movie, we'd started at Myung Chun's with her approval and enthusiastic support, making a movie. And it was then called the Brain Activity Mapping Project, BAM. So everything in the movie was all based on the whole notion of BAM, and I won't tell you what the effects were. And then suddenly, on the weekend of April the 2nd, everybody shot off to Washington, and I got a phone call, and it said it's now called BRAIN. And obviously people had said the word must be BRAIN and came up with that huge acronym, which we then had to build into the movie. But the reason I'm telling you about this is that there's a long process here which was going on, but it was still nevertheless surprising me with the activity that was going on and how a determined group of people could, within that space of time, end up with the president making that kind of an announcement. And I'm going to ask you in a minute as well, but since you were involved, I mean, aren't you shocked?
I was completely stunned. I have to say, when Ralph first called me up and told me about the outcome of the meeting, I wasn't able to attend. It occurred to me that, you know, this is a really crazy idea to record from all the neurons in the brain, which was Rafa Yusta's idea. But then I was reminded of something. One of my mentors when I was a graduate student in physics at Princeton, John Wheeler, legendary physicist, once told me something. I came to him with an idea. He said, "Terry, that's a crazy idea, but it's not crazy enough. Come back when you have a better one." And but it became clear that what was important about the idea wasn't necessarily recording from all the neurons, but creating the technology that allows you to record from enough neurons. And that was the key idea, to get the engineers together with the biologists, the tools and the questions. It's a match made in heaven. And I have to say, historically, over the last 30 years, there have been numerous attempts made by neuroscientists, the presidents of Society for Neuroscience, the head of the various institutes at NIH, have gone to Congress, have lobbied. How important it is for us to understand the basis of these mental disorders. Neuroscience really needs this support. And there was no traction. You know, everybody would say, yes, that's true. But, you know, it's too difficult. There's too much that has to be done, and you're already getting $5 billion a year. How much do you need? And so nothing happened. And so the miracle was, and this is something that Myung, I think, reported from the directors at NIH, is that this small idea, this kernel, managed to get to the right place at the right time and did have traction and caught the imagination not just of our president and our leaders, but the whole country. There's been a transformation that's occurred. And I talk to people every day that have nothing to do with neuroscience or academics for that matter, and they know about the Brain Initiative. Why? It's because the president made this national announcement. I have to tell you this one little story. A week after the announcement, Francis Collins, the director of the NIH, came to San Diego. He wanted to talk to our community. He could have gone anywhere, but he wanted to talk to our neuroscientists. And we had students there as well as neuroscientists. And one of the students, who was a Chinese graduate student, said on the day that the president made the announcement, she got a call from her mother from China saying, "Have you heard about the Brain Initiative? Are you working on it?" So this is clearly international implications. I was recently asked by a friend of mine from China inviting me to give a talk at the equivalent of the Society for Neuroscience, the Chinese Neuroscience Society. And they want to have a Brain Initiative too, and they wanted to know how to do it. So it's clear this has really had a huge impact on many, many people all over the world. And it's one of these opportunities, and Bob put it exactly right, it's generational. It's only going to happen once in our lifetime, and it's going to be, as I think, as important for our national effort and for the economy as the, going to the moon, President Kennedy's very inspiring decision.
Ralph? I mean, you're there from the beginning. How difficult was it to get a critical mass of people aboard the brain train?
Well, it was less difficult than any of us ever imagined it might be. And although Bob pointed out correctly that at our first meeting, the discussion that was sparked was by no means unanimous. And I was chuckling as soon as it began because the objections that were being raised against this idea were verbatim the same objections that were raised against the idea of the Genome Project 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I knew all those so well is that I had been one of the people raising those objections back then. I thought the Genome Project was a stupid idea because it was ill-framed, it was nebulous, it was going to waste a lot of time looking at parts of DNA that were of no interest to anyone, and that you could do the whole thing much more efficiently and effectively if you were targeted and sort of moved out from your targets. And I am happy to eat my words because I am one of many scientists who has benefited enormously in my day-to-day research from the fact of the project having been done, from the technology advances that it has fostered, from the ease of now sequencing any genome of any organism. We are just about complete doing the jellyfish genome. I will tell you at some other time why, in case you're curious. And people can now just do any genome that they want within a matter of weeks for a relatively small amount of money. This fact of the technology improvement has not only benefited basic science, it has made possible this whole concept of personalized medicine that we all hear about now because it's becoming a reality. And the technology development of the Genome Project was also surprising because it resulted in a return on investment that was phenomenal. And it was a study done by the Battelle Institute that we quoted in our first white paper to the White House because we thought an economic hook might help. And it turned out to be important because the president quoted it in his State of the Union address. By the way, that's how we knew that they had chosen the project. We had not been told up to that time that they were going to do it. And as soon as he said that, I literally fell off my chair because that meant that he had chosen it. And it was, of course, confirmed. But the point is that they studied it in the same way they study a corporation's return on investment. They used the same categories. They used the same metrics. And they came back with the ratio of 143 to 1, which is staggering.
I actually, your days at DARPA, I mean, did you imagine anything like this happening? Was there any sense of being within government or its agencies and having any clue that this sort of thing might happen?
Well, I can, yes and no, but I thought maybe I'd just give a little perspective on DARPA and sort of complex programs and how, you know, sort of how it works. So at DARPA, there's typically a $3 billion budget each year, and there's about 100 people who are program managers at any time, and I had the job of program manager. And as a program manager, it's your job to, you know, interact with the scientific community and the engineering communities and come up with, you know, great new projects that the agency should do. And so all program managers at DARPA do their best to do that. And I can guarantee you that every other program manager at DARPA thinks that your program is stupid. Okay? There's a kind of inherent competition that goes on in the organization where the program managers are essentially competing for money for their projects, and so it's very easy to be skeptical of another person's project. And so, you know, I suffered that, and so do all DARPA program managers. So the skepticism does a couple of things, though. It makes you tougher, makes your projects better, because you get a lot of criticism about what you're doing. And I think it's a healthy part, though a painful part of the process, that there should be skepticism. And, you know, DARPA is essentially an organization managing a portfolio of projects, and many of them, most of them, fail. In fact, we used to say, you know, if it isn't likely to fail, we shouldn't do it because it's not hard enough. So within a project that has the scope and the ambition of this BRAIN initiative, I sort of view it in a similar light. There will be many, many ideas pursued. Many of them will be bad. Many of them will fail. But there will likely be a few things that come out that are gigantic. And that's what you play for. If you don't play for that, and that's what DARPA does, if you can't invest in the big risky project, you really can't advance, you know, the technology, the society that depends upon it in the way that we come to expect things to advance. That's where they come from.
Yeah. Terry, go ahead.
So this is an interesting coincidence, because on the very day that Francis Collins came and visited UCSD, La Jolla, the director of DARPA, Arti Prabhakar, came to visit my lab. And what she said was that DARPA only funds projects that are likely to fail, and we got your name. No, she didn't quite say that, but she was testing the water. And what she told me was that the part that DARPA, because I'm on the committee and we need to coordinate with the engineering effort, that this is a high priority that for her personally within DARPA to build on their existing strengths. They have lots of strengths and sensors, and you need to sense the signals in the brain, and it has to be miniaturized. And they also have a big program in prosthetics. So what they can do now, they funded a lot of good neuroscience labs, Richard Anderson, John Donahue. It's possible to record now from several hundred neurons in the motor cortex of somebody who's paraplegic and have the person will a robot arm to pick up a cup of coffee and drink it. So that is a brain-machine interface. So, you know, we already can do that. And DARPA really sees this as a very important future part of their whole program, that they can accelerate this research with new materials. Todd's background is in materials research, science. And we need to have it biocompatible. And now I want just you to think a little bit about, you know, go fast forward here a couple of decades maybe. Now this is right now it's science fiction, but imagine if we could have a new sensory system in your brain and a new output system as well. You won't have to go to your computer to Google something, because you can Google your brain, which will then send it off to some supercomputer, and then it will come right back to this high bandwidth system. You will, in fact, you won't need a cell phone anymore. Sorry. Sorry.
Oh, well. Are you sure you're for this project now?
So you'll be building sensory systems, synthetic sensory systems.
I'm figuring out how to keep people from hacking into our brains.
But just be realistic, though, Terry. I mean, that's interesting science fiction vision, as you put it at the moment. But we also listed a number of debilitating diseases up there. And the progress on those seems to be rather halting, shall we say. So if, you know, we have a meeting here called the Stem Cell Meeting on the Mesa, which Duane and I have been doing for 8-9 years now, which is the first thing the Science Network actually did. If we were thinking about doing the Brain Meeting on the Mesa, which we are thinking of doing, what's the agenda for next year? What are the things that are realistic steps? I'm sure you'd love to have me replaced by synthetic.
Well, a year from now, we will have funding RFPs in place at NIH.
What's an RFP?
Request for Proposals.
Okay.
From NIH, NSF, and DARPA will have its own program. They don't have Request for Proposals. They just make it happen. But there will be enough in terms of goals, milestones, and priorities in place so that we'll actually know what the low-hanging fruit is that we can boost immediately by a factor of 2 or maybe 10. A lot of the existing technologies, optical technologies. Carl Dieseroth, for example, developed this new technique called optogenetics. That's in its infancy. That has another, at least a factor of 10 improvements can be made to that within the next year. And Carl's, in fact, one of the people on the committee that we're going to be meeting and setting priorities. So I think that even within the next first year, we are going to be able to show you results. And this is something that Jeff Ling, who was at the Caltech meeting, and I had this conversation with him, he said that, Terry, he said, Obama loves this project, personally, right? Did you hear that from Obama himself? And he wants to push it as far forward as fast as he can, but he needs our help. He needs us to sell it to the Congress and to the American people. We have to show them the promise. And if we can get their support, then the money's going to come. But so that's what we need to do. And a year from now, I hope we'll have things on the table that we can show that we've made progress.
Myung, let me ask you, having been largely responsible in the driver's seat for a lot of this thing, tell me what happened when you actually saw Obama. And the second thing, why was the Kavli Foundation, Bob Kahn, and you involved in this? I mean, for a foundation to be driving something with such an extraordinary result, I mean, what happened?
In effect, we get that question very often. And from inside, we're not surprised because we have, in certain ways, what we call sort of Kavli philosophy, where... Sure. Where in our case, we actually really understand going from great idea to the eureka moment in scientific discovery takes undoubtedly tenacious activities by scientists, but also it takes a lot of resources. And the biggest resources come from federal funding agencies, especially when it comes to basic science research. The funding discrepancy between federal money and then private sector is really large. So we foundations really have to be having some activities that will be different from federal funding agencies. And the philosophy for Kavli Foundation is that we like to utilize our advantage. Advantage is we make decisions really fast. For example, as a person who's running science programs at the foundation, if I have a great idea, I just walk to my president's office, which happens to be right next to me. And very often, enthusiastically, I'm telling him about the possibility. And in the middle of my sentence, Bob will tell me, go ahead and give it a try and then tell me if it works. It's that agility of making decisions, I think, makes huge difference. And So we utilize the capacity to work with scientists, and then we put together lots of workshops and look for great ideas. And then we then make those ideas into projects in this case.
What did the president say when you swam
out? Well,
is Terry right?
Well, he did say that he was sold first time he heard this initiative possibility. So that was really good.
Okay, thanks, Mia. You know, why don't we get some questions from folks? There's one at the back here. Okay. There you are.
Yes, Chris Bickford. When I was in medical school, the genome project was definitely thought to be way too huge and could never be solved, but it definitely had an endpoint, analyzing all of the DNA. For the full genome, is there any endpoint, and is there any specification other than mapping every neuron?
Well, I can speak to that a little bit because we were asked this question from day one. And the answer is that you can define, in principle, an endpoint as being when you reach the technical capability of being able to record from every neuron in a brain at the same time. That's something that has begun to be possible for very small brains. The zebrafish is a very nice example that has been published where they can now do that, although not at a fast enough time scale. In my lab, we have high hopes for the fruit fly being available for that relatively soon. But for larger brains, it's a very major problem. Before you even get to the point of worrying about how to do it in a human, it's not possible to do it in a mouse yet either. So you could say that that's a technical endpoint, one that is perhaps for ultimately very far off for humans, but at every step along the way, any advance that you make will help everybody in a sense. The people who make neuroprosthetics are currently dealing with a tiny, tiny dribble of brain activity. 100 neurons is nothing in a human brain. They say that if they could have 1,000, they would be vastly more capable to make a better device, more sensitive, easier to learn, and with greater capabilities. That's quite feasible. So that's what we mean when we say that this is the kind of thing where every step along the way will be of general value. In terms of answering questions, the genome didn't answer a question by completing it. It opened an enormous number of questions, which are still being grappled with. And some of the most difficult ones have to do with how the entire system functions. We're nowhere close to an answer on that yet. So these things open doors, but they open doors in ways where the outcome isn't only way far off in the future.
There's another one here.
Again, being a little more modest in terms of the goals, mapping the whole brain may seem a little less relevant than perhaps understanding a lot better a very particular area, for example, the visual cortex area, 19 or 18, whatever, a few millimeters of cortex, a few millimeter of understanding the columnar structure, will do a lot.
Yes. Okay, yeah. So
Terry can answer this.
So and that's probably a few million cells, but it will do a lot. Mm-hmm.
So when I organized the Caltech workshop, and we asked some of the best engineers and some of the best Tony Lewis is there, the companies to scope it out. The first question they asked, well, how many neurons? Give me a number. And I picked out of the hat 1 million. Why is that funny? Okay. No, it literally, because it needed a number, a benchmark. You can always scale it up and down. But it turns out 1 million is actually a pretty good number because there's less than 1 million neurons in the zebrafish brain, about 100,000. And there's about 100,000 neurons in the cortical column, about a cubic millimeter. And so if you were able to record and to stimulate selectively 1 million neurons, there are a lot of problems, a lot of questions, where that that really makes up most of the neural circuit responsible for behavior. So you would be able to, there are a lot of questions neurobiologists have that you would be able in a position to be able to answer. And so I call this the million neuron march.
So I like that number a lot because I pulled the same number out of my hat for the DARPA project. Mm-hmm. And I think it turns out that a million neurons is, you know, when you're thinking technologically, you can start to think about really doing things. So I also think a million is a good number.
Yeah, it was just that I had a visual image of
Irina Jetty, UCSD. Do you see what's the role of the human genome in mapping the, our brain? Thank you.
Well, I think that for some of these initial steps that we're talking about that involve development of technologies for actual recording, not much direct involvement in that aspect of it per se. However, the capabilities that the genome and related molecular biology kinds of projects have given in the ability to target modifications of function to specific cells and specific cell types has vastly increased the power of the studies that can be done in organisms like the mouse and the fruit fly, and even higher organisms using viral vectors to introduce these things. And the potential for doing that kind of work in humans is something that is not yet possible, but is certainly being worked on. By the same token, I think that it is also the case that there will be aspects of the data deluge that has come from the outgrowths of the genome studies. And how to handle that, how to analyze it, how to analyze systems where you have thousands, if not millions, of components interacting, that's extremely important. And the final point is a kind of work that's already being done by our colleagues at UCSD in a very forward-looking way. And that's actually doing gene mapping in humans for characteristics of the brain and for functions in the brain using these kinds of large-scale mapping techniques that now exist in order to ask about what are aspects of the genetic variation that affects these capacities in humans. And by the same token, what are the things that have gone awry in disease, and what is the genetic basis for those?
Yeah, you hit on something. My question was essentially related to what you're talking about. Terry, you mentioned neuroprosthetics and how that drove DARPA. I wonder how much this appreciation of systems approaches and computational neuroscience has actually risen at the various agencies so that where these are combining, essentially these two things are crossing, so people now believe, you know, maybe this is a feasibility, whereas before doing one-off neurons and not understanding that you can learn so much from systems approaches really plays a, you know, an important role in this.
So let me pick up on that, because this is very relevant for understanding brain principles of brain function. So when I first started working in computational neuroscience, this was 30 years ago, the reigning theory of the brain was called the grandmother cell theory. And here's how it went. Somewhere in your brain, there is a neuron that goes off, it activates at a high frequency whenever your grandmother visits you. Or you think about your grandmother, right? And you know, there's two questions. First of all, is it a plausible theory? Well, in fact, people had found more and more specific neurons. They found face neurons that would be activated by faces. And so it's not implausible that there is such a neuron in your brain. But here's a hypothetical question. Suppose one day that neuron died. Would that mean that you wouldn't recognize your grandmother? No, of course not. There must be backup neurons, right? And part of the reason why we had that theory was that we had a technique that allowed us to record from single neurons. So, of course, we had theories about the power of the single neuron. Fast forward, we now have brain imaging techniques. And now what we've begun to appreciate is that when you think about your grandmother, it's like billions of neurons all over your brain are being activated. And with different aspects of your grandmother, what she looks like, what she sounds like, what she smells like, you know, what the last thing she told you. You know, there's this tremendous amount of knowledge you have about your grandmother that's stored in different parts of your brain, different synapses. And so we're beginning to appreciate now that knowledge is very widely distributed, and it's somehow linking together, that it's communication between neurons distributed in distant parts of the brain that has to come together whenever you are going to make a decision or take an action. And that's the mystery, is how is that all that information organized? And unless we can record from enough neurons, from enough brain areas, we're not going to be able to ask answer that question.
Let's talk about the science of learning for a second. I see some people here from the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center at UCSD, and Terry, of course, is involved as well. One of the things that we're talking about there is essentially how do you build better learners instead of just getting rid of school boards or bad teachers. How do you build better learners? And the only thing that's common to all of those learners is the 3 pounds of wonder tissue on the end of their spinal column. So you would think that this initiative had something to do with the science of learning and the science of educating as well. And actually, Qualcomm is involved in science education, younger people as well, isn't it? I mean, do you want to speak to that?
How could the Brain Initiative be used? Well, I think we've probably had thoughts about it. You could imagine that if you could monitor, I mean, non-invasively, of course, the attentiveness, the brain activity of a learner, you could tune the educational content to maximize the uptake of information, and also to monitor when a person is paying attention, not paying attention, drifting. And so you could imagine an immersive, adaptive experience where you have a closed loop system to deliver the maximum amount of information to the learner. So it could be a completely different way of teaching young people on an individualized level. I think that's what this could open up.
But what does this have any relevance to all of those big million-dollar words like creativity and so on? There's a mass of books out about those sorts of things right now, which seek to explain it, but they don't seem to quite work in my view. So do you think that those kind of larger concepts are even within the purview of this project?
Well, those are going to be probably among the most difficult things to try to explain, if not only for the fact, among other things, that to explain something in a scientific fashion, you have to have a certain degree of regularity and reproducibility. And that's rather anathema to the notion of creativity in any given instance. People have certainly tried to see what are the characteristics, personality, cultural background, history, and so on, for those who are extraordinarily creative. But that's the kind of thing which, if it can be answered, will certainly require this kind of capability to do so. But I wouldn't necessarily
I disagree. Yeah. I think that if we had the capability to record from enough neurons, then not only would we be able to understand some aspects, not maybe everything, of creativity, but we would begin to understand an even more fundamental question, which is, how is it that you emerge from your neurons? You know, we all, understand that, what you think and what you feel is somehow coming out of those neurons. I mean, the astonishing hypothesis, Francis Crick wrote a book about this. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, we don't know how that happens. And it's because we don't have enough knowledge or information about how the neurons talk to each other and how that happens. But just think about it. Within our lifetime, it may be that we as a species will, for the first time, understand who we are, how we got here, in terms of our understanding. And it's not, by the way, all made from genes. We know that, for example, if you're an identical twin and one of the twins has schizophrenia, the concordance is only 50% that the second twin will also have schizophrenia. It means there's got to be some other factors that are important, which is your life experiences, things that actually happen to you. So I think that there's an enormous amount. This is going to have an enormous impact way beyond the technical side, the medical side. This is all about, the grand parts of culture, of language, of understanding, philosophical questions. This is really a remarkable opportunity that's going to occur.
All right, but go back to the brain train. I mean, obviously, understanding the gossip of neurons would be quite wonderful. But if you go back to the brain train, you saw in those carriages there was a worm in the first carriage.
Worms have thoughts too.
worse. And there was a fruit fly and a zebra.
And grandmother.
How many... Well, of course, Ralph, as a Drosophila specialist, has a wonderful fruit fly fight club.
I define myself as a Drosophila psychiatrist.
A fly shrink. How many... give me some sort of approximate timetable. Are all of those things being... Do all of those things have to be dealt with before you can get to the Virginia Woolf-like figure in The Last Carriage? Or do human things go on in parallel with this?
Certainly, many of the efforts need to and will go on in parallel, because the techniques that we have available to us to study a brain that's that tiny, that you can effectively see through in a microscope, are quite different and much more developed than those that are necessary to be able to see anything in a fast time scale and at a very fine level of resolution in a human brain. So it must go on in parallel. However, there is enough similarity in mammalian brains and enough of the same challenge for mammalian brains that it will be done initially in a mouse or a rat, where it's not going to be easy, but at least you can do far more to manipulate the system, and then we'll see. But yes, the efforts have to go on in parallel. And there are many things that already exist for human brain imaging, diagnosis, and so on, that will be improved, that will be enhanced, that will achieve a somewhat greater resolution. And that will help enormously when that happens.
So I have a kind of different hope, though, for the big picture stuff.
Okay.
Which is that, so my training is in physics, and I became a physicist, I think, because I unconsciously wanted to understand how the universe worked. And so I studied it for a long time, and I was profoundly disappointed at the end of the experience. And I think in part it's because it wasn't explaining the thing that I cared most about, which was sort of like, how do we get here, right? How does all this stuff happen? So here in this brain initiative, maybe we have a microcosm of that, which is, you know, emergence in the brain. And so I hold out hope that information that we might derive at the scale that Terry and Ralph talk about would provide theorists something to work with, which they don't have much of right now. You know, we need a theory that transcends scale in the brain so that we can understand it better. The analogy that I would give, the part of physics that I always liked and hated most was thermodynamics, until it came to statistical physics, which I thought was an elegant way of describing a very difficult thing. And that's what I hold out hope for. Yeah.
Okay, well, if this were a brain, one of the hemispheres is very quiet over here. So, is there somebody? Yeah, okay, great.
Yes, I was wondering, you were talking about needing money to fund programs. And I was thinking a great motivating company would be pharmaceutical companies. They would want to be first on the list, I would think. And I'm wondering, are there going to be sharing of information between the science colleges and the business corporations?
I think that we will do everything we can to interest companies like that. And one of the functions of this organization that Duane runs is to facilitate those kinds of interactions. And certainly we on the campus at UCSD have many people whose job it is to help us facilitate those kinds of interactions as well. So it's one of the many avenues that we certainly intend to explore.
So Ralph, since we have a captive Duane Roth, let me ask him to...
So, you know, that's what I started out. The hope here is that we can find the rationale of why these diseases happen and do something to correct them. Most of these you're not born with. You inherit them, you develop them over time. And if we can figure that out, then I think there can be hope for all of these diseases. And, you know, while the science is the floor this is built on, the products are the things that will make people healthier.
Thanks. Now, there was one down there. Yeah.
So I'm not a neurobiologist, so forgive me if the question is not smart. But is there a concern that advancement of technology and a special initiative like that sometimes exceeds the ability of a human brain to understand it, and maybe actually leads to some neurological, psychological disorders. Mm-hmm. Is there a concern like that? And if it is, then how do you address that?
I mean, kind of a knowledge overload coming out of this sort of thing.
I just don't think that the human brain is possible sometimes to grasp.
Well, I think there's a certain sense in which we certainly can't see enough at one time to be able to analyze these massive parallel time series of data that will be coming out. But on the other hand, and so one of the important challenges in this entire initiative is developing the computational and analytical capability to handle that, which is another aspect that will have very broad applications when it is done successfully. Because we have that problem in all kinds of realms of human activities, even beyond science. But the point that comes out of having that capability is that we know that there's enough richness, variation, and uniqueness in the way every human brain does things, and the lack of reproducibility from moment to moment of that, that it's not going to pop out as some obvious pattern of data that's just sitting there waiting for us to see, at least not in my opinion. So people have to have ideas. People have to have theories. They have to have frameworks to bring to test against those data sets. And that's certainly the way astrophysics and physics in general have proceeded. And that's no less different here.
So I can add a footnote to that, which is that why now? In other words, could we have started this brain initiative 10 years ago? And the answer is no. It's because of the fact that the computers didn't have the capacity. The techniques weren't mature enough yet. And at a meeting that Tony and I were at Caltech, where we had representatives from Google and from Microsoft, as well as Qualcomm, what they told us was that, look, we've done the calculation here. We've solved these problems. Google is not just overloaded, but superloaded with information about you, about everything that happens in the world, transactions, commerce, personal information, world information, statistics, economy. And they have solved a lot of the problems of how you interrogate it. How is it you search it? How is it that you answer questions? It's still a work in progress, but the point is there's a whole field of engineering and mathematics called machine learning, which has developed techniques for handling very, very large, massive data sets and for being able to work in high-dimensional spaces. This is the arena that nature evolved in. Our brains evolved to handle massive amounts of data. So in a sense, Google is just now getting up to speed. We've just now, as a species, been able to reach the same capacity. But this is the whole planet has a storage capacity about the same now as your brain. But it's reaching that point now where we understand some of the basic principles that we'll be able to use to understand the brain. That's the beauty. That's why now.
So, Terry, you commented on the importance of innovative technologies. Where are the key areas you think where the technologies need to move forward dramatically to achieve the million neuron milestone?
So, I actually have a complete faith in creativity, in the sense that if you ask, you're asking the wrong person. I'm looking around the room here, right? I see a lot of gray beards and gray-haired people. It's the future. The future of the people who are going to come up with the really important ideas are probably not in this room today. It's probably students and grad students, undergraduates, who are really excited and they're going to throw their careers into this. And they're the ones that we need to inspire. And I think that's the group that Obama is reaching out to. And There is actually one person in the room. I just want to single out. Her name is Susie from UCSD. Could you stand up, please? So I have to tell you this wonderful story. I got an email today from Leanne Chukowski, who is a former postdoc in my lab. And she said, you have to meet Susie. And I said, fine. So it turns out Susie is a student at UCSD. And she couldn't afford to come to this meeting because there was a cover charge, right? Was it $50? Okay, so here's what she did. Very creative student. You know, there's this Sun God Festival over at UCSD, and the students are given free tickets. She sold hers for how much?
$65.
So she could be here. Okay, that's initiative.
Yes, and I can chime in on the fact that ever since the announcement of this initiative by the president, and even prior to that in the newspapers, every place that any of us has gone to speak, the graduate students and postdocs are inspired and they're fired up because they all now feel as though there's actually some hope for the future. Because all they were hearing and all they've been hearing for the past several years is how hard it is to get funded, how hard it is to find jobs, how bad the outlook is for basic science. This has really given them hope, and not unreasonably. It shouldn't be unqualified because it's not there yet, but it has been a huge boost for morale.
Okay, so two last questions. Drew Senni, then Steve DeBell over there.
So I have a question regarding the guiding ethical principles for this project. So for example, we're not doing human cloning, though we probably could. And maybe someone's doing it already, but certainly not in the mainstream. Who's going to decide what are the ethical sort of third rails or things that you will or won't do?
So at the announcement that was made on April 2nd, President Obama made a special announcement, along with the announcement, kind of a footnote, saying he was going to ask his ethical committee to work closely with the scientists. And I think this is absolutely essential. In other words, as these ideas are being developed, we need to know what some of the consequences could be and what things should not be done, perhaps, or at least done more slowly. So there are others who are experts at this, who understand some of the ramifications. And by the way, we probably don't yet know what the applications are going to be yet. We have a very bad imagination. So someone once asked somebody at RCA who invented the television set, what impact is your invention going to have? And they said, it would revolutionize the telephone. So, if you ask us right now, we wouldn't know what the most important applications are going to be. No one knows. But there should be someone who's already thinking about, if there are going to be applications that are going to affect lots of people, we have to understand what the impact is going to be. And so Obama is aware of that, and a lot of us are aware of that. And that was actually in our article, too.
Yeah,
perspective.
And Francis Collins, the director of NIH, who was one of the pioneers of the Genome Project, pointed out when he in his announcement of this that the ethical concerns were up front addressed at the dawn of the Genome Project, before they had the capability of really pulling it off. And he said that that will be no less true in this initiative as well. So people are quite aware of the importance of this, the essential nature of it. I should also point out it's been explored here on the Mesa in recent years as one of the many topics that the Center for Science and Ethics at UCSD, which Mike Kalishman runs, dealt with several years ago, in which he assembled various neuroscientists and philosophers and ethicists and so on to address what might be the possibilities and what would be the issues related to them. And this was actually published in an issue of the journal Science and Ethics.
Yeah, we did 3 years of meetings at the Science Network as well, called Beyond Belief, that dealt with science, ethics, and social policy as well. And of course, nobody knows where any of this basic research is going to lead. The old apocryphal story I suppose, about Michael Faraday being visited by the English Prime Minister, who said, well, what use is this, Mr. Faraday, this electricity and magnetism business? And he said, well, eventually, Prime Minister, you'll be able to tax it. So there's another story, which the response is, what use is a newborn baby? But you've heard that one as well. Now, Steve, are you still ready for a question?
I'm right here. Rock. One of the more fascinating aspects of brains is that they change. And I'm wondering how all of you imagine that this plasticity feature of the brain will be part of your future endeavors. How will you deal with it?
Well, it has to be, because it is so intrinsically important. And as you well know, you know as well as any of us, some of the changes occur very quickly, others take longer. And one thing that will certainly be possible is to be able to better monitor how, when that happens, to what extent that happens, where it happens, with respect to various kinds of functions, tasks. And this also feeds directly into Terry's point about learning and the additional boost to the capabilities we have for understanding and enhancing can also be addressed by that. So it will be as much a part of it as any of the activity patterns that become observable.
By the way, one of the biggest mysteries that we have in front of us is the fact that the brain you have today is not the same brain you had when you were young, mm-hmm. or when you were born. And part of the, and one of the reasons is that every single protein in your brain turns over with the time scale of hours to days. So it's like the axe that, you know, someone bought 20 years ago. Well, you know, they've replaced the handle twice and the axe head three times. Is it the same axe? And how is it you can have memories that last for a lifetime if everything is dynamic? And we've seen synapses coming and going in the cortex. It's always turning over. There has to be some basic core element of the brain somewhere that we don't yet fully understand, which codes your deepest memories and the longest living memories that you have, and which makes you personally, you know, your specific history is all encoded there somewhere. And that's going to be a problem that will require not just brain activity, but brain chemistry, right? It's got to be in the structure of the brain and the chemical composition of the brain.
Okay, so apparently outside, your bodies will transport your brains outside, and you'll find there's refreshments for your brains out there. Let us thank the panelists so much. Thanks to Dwayne Roth and Connect and Teresa Andrews, I don't know where she is, and thanks enormously to the Kavli Foundation, Myung Chan as well. Let me leave you. This is my last thought. From the NIH piece, which quotes President Obama ending his announcement of the Brain Initiative by saying, "I don't want our children or grandchildren to look back on this day and wish we'd done more to keep America at the cutting edge. I want them to look back and be proud that we took some risks, that we seized this opportunity." So, take some risks. Good night.